Chapter 31. What is your cast? There was still half a sack of wood chips left when Swami Agamananda sent an emissary to see how we were getting on. Swami Dharmananda, who had called in at the Kaladi ashram while we were there, was a short, dark, slightly corpulent man of about 40, clad in a saffron-coloured shirt that reached almost to his ankles. It was soon evident, from the turn he contrived to give the conversation, that the motive of his visit was less altruistic than we had supposed, and that he was interested not so much in our welfare as in our identity. Some months later we discovered that he was reputed to be an agent of the secret police. But this was not necessarily the explanation of his curiosity. In India, particularly in South India, people rarely feel at ease with a stranger until they know his caste, language, income, marital status, and family history. Should this information not be immediately forthcoming, they do not drop the matter, as people in most other countries would do, but press it in a manner so vigorous and aggressive as to suggest that they have a right to know. The original reason for this extraordinary behaviour is to be found in the caste system. Hindu society consists of about 2,000 castes. Every Hindu belongs by birth to one of them. A casteless Hindu is a contradiction in terms. Relations between castes are regulated by the socio-religious manuals, known as Dharma Shastras. Until a Hindu knows a man's caste, he is uncertain whether he may eat and drink with him, or even touch him. So acute is the discomfort created by this state of uncertainty that orthodox Hindus, especially Brahmins, will go to almost any lengths of rudeness in order to wrest from the uncommunicative this vital secret. Though during recent years the rigidity of the caste system has been slightly relaxed, especially in towns and cities, and the practice of untouchability made a penal offence, much of the personal inquisitiveness that was necessitated originally by the requirements of the caste system is still operative in the makeup of people who believe themselves devoid of caste prejudice. Malabar, that is to say, Travancore and the adjacent Malayalam-speaking areas, we found even worse in this respect than Tamil Nadu. Once we had told a Tamil Brahmin that a sadhu possessed neither caste nor nationality, the matter could usually be regarded as closed. Not so with the Malayalis. They insisted on pursuing the argument to the bitter end. Though Swami Dharmananda was less obstreperous than many whom it was our misfortune to encounter, he certainly made up in resourcefulness what he lacked in vehemence. But, having spent several days bruising himself in vain against the wall of our resolution, he apparently decided that direct methods were of no avail, and thenceforward allowed the discussions to flow into normal channels. When he stopped playing the Inquisitor, we discovered that his company was by no means uncongenial. Not that he was a saint, but he was shrewd, sensible, and well-informed, and knew much about Travancore that we were desirous of learning. Having been so reticent about our own caste and nationality, we could hardly question him concerning his antecedents. From his undisguised hostility to Brahmins, however, as well as from the darkness of his complexion, we concluded him to be a member of the Nair community. Moreover, in order to encourage communicativeness on our part, he had confided to us that he had once belonged to the Ramakrishna Mission. He also seemed to have been somehow connected with the Mahabodhi Mission in Calicut, in what was then known as British North Malabar. Now, he told us, he spent most of his time travelling up and down the state delivering lectures. The Malayalis had an inordinate passion for attending lectures. Travancore was in fact the only place in India where people were so addicted to this form of entertainment that they paid the lecturer not only his travelling expenses, but a fee for his speech. Like many sadhus, Swami Dharmananda explained, He made several hundred rupees a month by this means. Not being deeply interested in religion, he preferred to speak either on politics or on social questions, such as the abolition of the caste system. But he had no objection to lecturing on religion, for this was still the most popular and lucrative topic. Before returning to Kaladi, he predicted that we would soon be inundated with invitations to address meetings. After this prediction, we were not astonished when, a few days later, arrangements were made for us to speak at a public meeting in Muvatuputsa. Swami Agamananda, who had evidently been apprised of our determination to remain at the ashram despite the wood chips, came over for the day to preside. So great was the Malali's love of lectures, and so intense the curiosity that had been excited by our arrival, that practically the entire literate population of the town turned up to hear and see the two young ascetics. Though he was not unaware of our feelings in the matter, Swami Agamananda introduced Satchapriya as a Bengali and me as an American. This gave him an opening for a vigorous attack on the Christian missionaries, his avowed enemies, whom he ridiculed for trying to convert Indians to Christianity when cultured Westerners were voluntarily adopting Hinduism. To him, Buddhism was a caste-cum-sect within the Hindu fold. Satchapriya and I then spoke for half an hour each. Swami Agamananda concluded by appealing to the public of Muvatuputsa to support the ashram and to cooperate with its new incumbents. On our return to the ashram, a committee was set up with Swami Agamananda as president, Anagarika Satchapriya as secretary, Anagarika Dharmapriya as assistant secretary, and Mr. Ramaswami Iyer, who, with about a dozen other gentlemen, had walked back with us, as treasurer. Ramaswami promised 10 rupees a month. The others pledged 1 rupee each. A list of subscribers, potential and actual, was drawn up, and Satchapriya and I were instructed to go from house to house for subscriptions at the beginning of every month. From the 1st of December, therefore, our daily routine underwent an important modification. Every morning after breakfast, we crossed the bridge into Muvatuputsa and made the rounds of as many houses as possible, returning to the ashram at about midday. In the beginning, we had assumed it would be possible for us to collect the subscriptions of all the members of the ashram, as they were styled, within 2 or 3 days. But as our list grew longer, and the town apparently more extensive, the work lingered on into the first, into the second, and finally even into the third week of each month. Members were not always at home when we called, and even if they were, they sometimes asked us to call again later, as they happened to be without money just then. Moreover, with most of the subscribers on our list, who at the peak of our activity numbered nearly 100, we were soon on terms of friendship, even in a few cases of familiarity. For this development, Satchapriya's extreme sociability was mainly responsible. In consequence, we acquired the habit of visiting certain houses more often and staying much longer than our business required. This was no doubt of greater benefit to us than spending the whole of our time at the ashram. Apart from getting more exercise, we became closely acquainted with Muvatuputsa and its people, and learned much about the manners and customs, the beliefs and practices of the various castes and communities of the state. Like Trivandrum, Muvatuputsa contained more open spaces and houses, and more trees than people. The three rivers which gave the town its name made a rough T that trisected it into three unequal segments. These segments were connected by two bridges, the first of which crossed the river forming the left arm of the T about a mile before it reached the confluence, while the second crossed the river forming the upright about the same distance down from the confluence. By far the greater portion of the town lay under the left arm of the T, between the two bridges. In the middle of this segment, Equidistant from the bridges stood a small conical hill. After crossing the bridge from the ashram, we turned right in the direction of the town. Presently the road forked. One could reach the first bridge by going either round to the right of the hill through the Brahmin quarter, or round to the left past the Roman Catholic Church, the Government Hospital, the Unchal Office, the Anglican Church, the Toddy Shop, the Courts, and a row of Western-style shops, which, in the course of a year, nearly doubled in length. Usually we went into town by one route and returned by the other. Sometimes, crossing the first bridge and turning right, we made our way through the crowded bazaar quarter to the sandy shores of the confluence, where we crossed over to the ashram bank of the river in a country boat, which on market days was so overloaded that it almost foundered. During the rains, the confluence measured nearly a mile across, but in summer the rivers shrank within their channels to such an extent, and the water became so shallow, that after hitching our robes above our knees, we could wade from one bank to the other without much difficulty. Only at the centre, not the geographical centre, of the town, at the two ends of the first bridge, and in the bazaar, did one see a few rows of shops and houses built end to end after the Western pattern. Practically all the other houses, including those scattered up and down the hillside, as well as government offices and public buildings, stood four square in their own compounds, in every one of which slim white coconut palms reared themselves 50 and 60 feet high, their gently swaying heads crowned with a mass of nodding green plumes. One could hardly tell where the town ended and the countryside began. When one reached the suburbs, paddy fields started appearing in between the low compound walls. But even in the heart of the town, where houses were thickest and compounds smallest, we occasionally found that a short cut from one house to another led through a field of grain or across freshly ploughed land. The houses with the most character were the tiled, heavily timbered, red laterite mansions of the traditional Malabar type. Some of the older and perhaps more purely indigenous specimens were built entirely of teak that had grown black with age. A few were thatched instead of tiled. Not a pane of glass, not a single nail or screw or hinge had been used in their construction. The small, low windows were closed with stout wooden bars. Massive folding doors of 4-inch thick teak turned on wooden pegs that fitted into sockets in the door frame and were barred on the inside by a heavy teak sliding bolt. The floors were paved with black stone. A dusty table and a chair or two, obviously unused except by visitors, were usually the only concessions to modernity. On the walls, among garish lithographs of the blue Vishnu astride his bird mount Garuda, with one arm round each of his plump, homely spouses, and a medley of other Hindu gods and goddesses, hung large framed portraits of various members of the British royal family, from Queen Victoria down to King George VI. Though dark, the interiors of these old houses were delightfully cool, and after a long walk in the hot, bright sun, Satyapriya and I found it pleasant to relax in a dusty chair and allow our eyes to become accustomed to the gloom, while our host, who was generally a Nair, disappeared into the yet darker back premises to fetch us one of the traditional cold drinks. For the first 2 or 3 months that we went out on our rounds, we were often pestered by inquiries concerning our caste and nationality. Though we found them rather trying, neither of us could help laughing at the ridiculous, even comical, manner in which they were sometimes made. A perfect stranger, passing us in the road, would stop, fix us with a fish-like stare, and without a word of explanation, demand of us, in hollow, sepulchral tones, "What is your nationality?" Our favourite reply was that we were Sadhus and had none. If the questioner was deficient in effrontery, or in English, He would look us up and down very deliberately, in silence, for a few minutes, and then move slowly off, keeping us fixed with the same fish-like stare as he did so. When asked, "What is your caste?" we replied, or rather Satchapriya replied, that we were Buddhists and as such did not believe in this institution. This almost always led to an argument. Everybody had a caste, we were told, and among the Orthodox, our reticence on this important particular told against us, for to them it was a matter of common experience that the lower a man's caste, the more reluctant he was to reveal it. Attempts to explain that there were countries outside India and religions other than Hinduism which knew nothing of caste were met on the part of the semi-literate by an incredulous silence. The more persistent type of questioner, vexed by our uncommunicativeness, would proceed to ask such subtle leading questions as, "Where were you born?" and "What is your mother tongue?" To the latter question, Satchapriya replied that he knew 13 languages, which was true in a sense. Being a much less gifted linguist, I said nothing. Some questioners became argumentative. "Why shouldn't a sadhu tell his nationality?" they would demand belligerently. "He can't be universal at heart." If we happened to be in a hurry, we generally left such people arguing in the middle of the road. Had their inquiries been conducted with greater reasonableness, we might have felt tempted to break the resolution we had made on leaving Kasauli. As it was, the fact that nothing about us seemed to interest them so much, or concern them so deeply, as our caste, made us all the more determined to lessen them in the minor importance of such distinctions, by firmly adhering to the principles we had adopted. Eventually, when our attitude became generally known, the persecution ceased. Thereafter, whoever stopped and fixed us with a fishy stare, we knew must be a stranger to the town. When Satchapriya was in a jovial mood, he would sometimes be the first to put the well-known question, imitating with great success the tone in which it was usually asked. Spluttering with suppressed mirth, we would then escape, leaving the would-be questioner looking after us with a sagging jaw and an expression of bewilderment. Despite the success of these light-hearted methods with members of the public, a day came when it seemed that our reticence regarding our antecedents would get us into serious trouble with the authorities. We received a summons to the police station. Unlike the people of Muvattuputsa, who took an equal interest in us both, especially in our caste, the station superintendent seemed concerned exclusively with me and my nationality. All foreigners, he explained, were now required to register with the police, and since it was suspected that I belonged to this category of persons, I had been called for interrogation. Would I kindly state my nationality? Had I replied that I was English, all would have been well, for the registration order did not apply to citizens of the United Kingdom and other Commonwealth countries, who were not classified as foreigners. Official suspicion had, in fact, been excited only by Swami Agamananda's unfortunate description of me as an American. But, as Satchapriya and I had insisted for 3 or 4 months that as sadhus we had neither caste nor nationality, stoutly resisting all attempts to extract from us the much-prized information, we felt we could now hardly retract. Perhaps there was also a grain of obstinacy in our attitude. Fortunately, the station superintendent took a lenient view of the case, merely remarking after a few supplementary questions that he would have to report to headquarters that a person suspected of being a foreigner was residing in the vicinity and had refused to declare his nationality. A few weeks later came a second summons. On our arrival at the police station, we found that the station superintendent had been transferred. His successor, a strapping, handsome young Nair of about my own age, was the son of one of our ashram members, a teacher in the local middle school, and we had already met him at his father's house before his appointment. This, of course, made things much easier for us. after he had put me the same questions as his predecessor, and I had given the same replies. We enrolled him as a member of the ashram and collected his first subscription. Thereafter, the police station was included in our regular monthly itinerary. On one of our visits, the young superintendent showed us the lock-up, where we saw, behind bars, half a dozen desperate-looking characters who were awaiting trial on charges of theft and murder. For several days afterwards, we speculated whether this gesture was meant to be taken as a hint, but as no further official interest was taken in us, we eventually dismissed the suspicion as unfounded. The authorities, it seemed, were more easily satisfied than some of our acquaintances.